For those of you who are in the habit of reading the notes on the hymns, you may have noticed that the hymn was also based on Isaiah 55. And so we have moved from this ancient, very particular Hebrew take on the need for freedom of conscience into a much wider linkage of all of it to nature and to the gifts of perception of the sacred that come with the wider world, but still coming from that same story with that modern hymn. So I'm going to be talking about a problem and an opportunity and an aspect of humanity that's been on our minds as people of faith for thousands of years. And let's start with a story I could have told last week, but I saved for this morning. Those of you who were here or who read the sermon or listened to it online know that I quoted Sarah Miles, who identified as a former Mother Jones reporter turned Christian social activist. And in that sermon, I agreed with her statement that religion is not so much about swallowing beliefs as it is about learning to see. I still agree with that, so much so that I wouldn't mind seeing that out on our sign for a month. Religion is not so much about swallowing beliefs as it is about learning to see. Now, Ms. Miles was raised as an atheist. Her parents actually were Christian missionaries, but they had rejected their religion, and that explains the household that she grew up in. She was 46 years old in 1998 when the story I'm going to share begins. She was an experienced war correspondent. She was a restaurant cook. She was a lesbian activist. She was former editor of Mother Jones, which is a politically left-wing magazine that takes its name from a famous labor organizer from over a century ago. Miss Miles first walked into the St. Gregory of Nyssa Episcopal Church in what is historically a poor working class neighborhood of San Francisco on a whim. She was drawn in by the beauty of the building. Inside, she encountered people singing and paintings of saints that, to her surprise, included Malcolm X. People were gathered around the altar, sharing the bread and wine of the Christian communion. She was fed, she broke down crying, and then she fled, fearing the people would take her to be a Christian. But she returned soon after and started participating in the feeding of others in that communion. And she discovered that to her, the communion ritual was literally about feeding, and that this was her calling. So she became a Christian convert, eventually a lay minister in that church, and she ran food programs in the church and all around the city. I'm going to let her speak for herself for a minute from the prologue of her book published in 2007, Take This Bread. My new vocation didn't turn out to be as simple as going to church on Sundays, folding my hands in the pews, and declaring myself saved. I had to trudge in the rain through housing projects, sit on the curb wiping the runny nose of a psychotic man, take the firing pin out of a battered woman's .357 Magnum, then stick the gun in a cookie tin in the trunk of my car. I had to struggle with my atheist family, my doubting friends, and the prejudices and traditions of my newfound church. I learned about the great American scandal of the politics of food, the economy of hunger, and the rules of money. I met thieves, child abusers, millionaires, day laborers, politicians, schizophrenics, gangsters, and bishops, all blown into my life through the restless power of a call to feed people, widening what I thought of as my community in ways that were exhilarating, confusing, often scary. What I found wasn't about arguing a doctrine, the virgin birth, predestination, the sinfulness of homosexuality and divorce, or pledging blind allegiance to a denomination. I was, as the prophet said, hungering and thirsting for righteousness. I discovered a religion rooted in the most ordinary yet subversive practice, a dinner table where everyone is welcome, where the poor, the despised, and the outcasts are honored. Well, I save that story for this week because it reminds me of why our fifth principle reads as it does. Unitarian Universalists originally linked these words endorsing democracy to what is today the first principle affirming worth and dignity of every person, as Bob Geiger noted in his sermon. And now we have reshuffled the deck on our principles, and it is linked to the free exercise of conscience. Our freedom to act, as Sarah Miles does, out of a hunger for righteousness. Now, this linkage echoes the ancient wisdom preached by the prophet Isaiah to the Jews living in the Babylonian captivity. Now, the book of Isaiah, if you go to seminary and they start taking it apart for you, is believed to be written over a period of time by three different prophets. And Isaiah 55, that particular passage sits right in the middle in a place where they're not sure which prophet wrote it. But they believe it takes place at or just after the end of the Babylonian captivity. And the Israelites, which were not every Israelite, but all of the cream of society, have been taken to Babylon as prisoners. And now they're in an interesting position. They've been there for 60 years by some accounts, a little longer by others. And some of them have found a place in that society. They're still captives. There's limits on what they can do. But leaving to go back to Jerusalem, which they don't know what's there, is maybe not the most exciting prospect. So the prophets, not just Isaiah, but the other leaders of the community, have a big problem convincing people to leave, even if they get the chance. And this argument is that they are getting their physical needs met, but there is something much more important that cannot be met as captives in a society where they cannot freely practice their religion and their right of conscience. And Isaiah is warning them, just don't get too comfortable with this. It's going to starve you in a way that really is important. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread? For your labor for that which does not satisfy? So I called Bob Geiger's reading the fifth principle in our order of service because that's the focus of the particular passage that I had Martha read. His actual sermon title was Defending Democracy in the Age of Trump, which brings us back to the welcome table in our opening hymn. That table is an image of what life looks like when food and freedom go hand in hand. Sarah Miles found a version of it at St. Gregory's in San Francisco. I'm looking for CVUUS to be known as a welcome table, and I hope you are too. I want it to happen in this world, not as we sang in the song, one of these days, which in the original spiritual is often referred to the afterlife. Sarah Miles has a definition of the purpose of the Christian church that I really like. The church is not there to get people to believe in Jesus, but to feed people so that they can go out and be Jesus. So let me translate that into Unitarian Universalist terms, which of course means more words. The purpose of our congregation is not to get you to believe our principles. It is to feed people spiritually and when necessary, physically. And we do that so that no one need feel alone in our work to make the world more just, beautiful, and compassionate. Say that again. We're here to feed people spiritually and when necessary, physically. You know why I'm saying it that way? We saw Porgy and Bess yesterday, and "it ain't necessarily so" is ringing in my mind. But we're here to feed people spiritually and when necessary, physically. We do that so that no one need feel alone in our work to make the world more just, beautiful, and compassionate. Now that added power of we magnifies how crucial it is that we defend our right to democracy, including the protection of minority and marginalized opinion. The shorthand version of democracy too often leaves out that essential point. Now, democracy doesn't guarantee freedom to follow our conscience or good choices in how we do that. H.L. Mencken, the famously cynical writer, once called democracy the worship of jackals by jackasses. And if you like things put a little more politely, the first Unitarian president, John Adams, said, "Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide." Now, I have to say, if I'm going to be honest in this argument, you could even argue that democracy is not well suited to certain challenges. History suggests that authoritarian regimes, like China's today, for instance, could move much more rapidly than Western democracies to seriously address climate change if those in power decide to do so. Look how quickly they changed the growth of population in China through their national edicts. In the end, though, I agree with our fifth principle and with Winston Churchill's famous backhanded praise that no other form of government has proven to be better than democracy. There are, of course, innumerable ways to measure what we mean by better. Is it better if we make citizens safer? Is the measure whether we make more people wealthy? Is the measure whether we make people happy or we give people longer lives? To name a few. But a sense of being well-fed physically, emotionally, and spiritually could stand in for all of these different measures, as I see it. It's inconceivable that we can know anything essential about what life is without considering what constitutes food and how it moves through our economic, political, and social systems. I can't think of anything that presents conscious, daily ethical choices in my life more often than the question of what I eat. Every day, what and how I eat reminds me how free and privileged I am, how my aspirations have evolved over the years about eating, and how often I fall short of my best intentions. So if you want something that's bringing up those spiritual challenges daily, food is a pretty good place to start. Now, all this means I think about food a lot over the course of years in writing sermons. One aspect that I don't get to as often as I should, probably because I associate it more with the breaks I take in my writing than with the messages I'm crafting, is the connection between food and feelings of joy. When you live with a baker, any break in your work tends to bring on feelings of joy. But I was reminded this week when I read a Wendell Berry essay from 30 years ago that there's some deeper thought that's gone into the connections between pleasurable eating and freedom. Berry argued in his essay, The Pleasures of Eating, that most Americans no longer realize that a significant part of the pleasure of eating is one's accurate consciousness of the lives and the world from which the food comes. Now, this is talking about the lives of the things that become food, but also the lives of everybody who prepares and gets us that food. And he goes on to say, eating with the fullest pleasure, pleasure that is, that does not depend on ignorance, is perhaps the profoundest enactment of our connection with the world. Eating with the fullest pleasure, pleasure that does not depend on ignorance, is perhaps the profoundest enactment of our connection with the world. Berry also worried that consumer ignorance of what goes into getting food onto our tables has resulted in the loss of our freedom to make responsible choices. Not only were we missing out on pleasure, as he defined it, we were destroying our health and our planet by not making responsible choices because we are too often ignorant. Now, I can see a lot of ways that many of us have caught up with Berry's thinking in the 30 years since he wrote that essay, especially here in Vermont. Just speaking personally, I get great pleasure out of Michelle and I being able to associate names and faces and individual farms and food product facilities, as well as our garden, with a substantial percentage of our food. But as I read this essay, I wondered about a fascinating new twist on all of this that Berry did not anticipate. So if you've been reading the news lately, you've been seeing more and more about plant-based meat substitutes and meat products grown from cell cultures rather than live animals. They carry names like the Impossible Burger and Clean Meat. I think over at Two Brothers, they have the Beyond Burger, which is a competitor for the Impossible Burger. Now, these inventions might vastly reduce the contribution of our food chain to climate change. Not an unimportant issue. Their adoption would also be breakthroughs for animal welfare advocates. They won't, however, reduce the role of industry in the food systems, nor will they bring consumers closer to experiences of eating as connecting them to life and Earth itself. And they won't be inexpensive for consumers. So all of this creates a lot of conflict and different ways of looking at things that Barry didn't anticipate in the beginning of this farm-to-table discussion that has become an important part of our lives. So for me, that says the look of conscientious free choices in the food chain could be evolving dramatically in the next 10 years. There's a lot of things at play which could affect choices that we want to make conscientiously. Our power to vote on what future we want seems more precious spiritually than ever when I look at it through this lens. So let's cherish the ways that this congregation embodies the fifth principle in our lives and in the wider community, the ways that it fosters our right of consciousness, it encourages us to come together and model how democratic decisions are made, encourages us to tell stories to our kids that hold up the possibilities of democracy. May we eat what is better than tasty, as the ancient prophets urged. May we demand the freedom to serve up love and goodness with every bite. And once we've demanded that freedom and obtained it, let us then take the step of exercising it. May it be so.